Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And she uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. What are we up to today?
Well, today's show, I have a guest in the studio, and I'm, as always, excited to have the conversation. I'd love to find interesting people. You know, my underlying theme of the program is finding ordinary people doing extraordinary things. There's a lot of people out there, you know, self-promoting and pushing books and pushing their brand and pushing their story, and they get lots of press and they get plenty of attention. But I'm so interested in the people who are just like ordinary folk doing their life, and then they find the ability or the calling to do extraordinary things. And when I meet those people, I want to have them on the air because I think the most important thing we can do for our mental health and well-being as individuals and as people is to realize that we all have our gifts. We all have those lights inside of us that are important to share. And part of our work as humans is to tap into whatever that light is. And unfortunately, we get overwhelmed because the cultural story is there are experts who have all the knowledge and that we should bow down to experts no matter what the field is, from medicine to the media to fashion, to psychology, that we idolize experts who have been, you know, focusing monomaniacally on one subject forever and now deemed to have all the answers. And that takes our power away. It's important to have knowledge and information. It's good that there are people who study things and have the knowledge and information, but it does not make them the experts in our own individual lives. And we've become accustomed to handing over our power to these experts and believing them, and in many ways not in our best service, not in best service to ourselves. And so I like to talk to people who have trusted their inner voice, who have come up against incredible odds and found answers that worked for them, and then take that out and share it to the world. So that's what's floating in my head, and this theme, this idea of learning to work with the hand that life has dealt us, learning to love the life that we've been given, learning to find wholeness and peace amongst the shatters of our lives or the shattered pieces of our lives, because we're always in the process of coming together or falling apart. That's just the nature of the human experience, that our life is a series of moments of grace and glory, and then incredibly long periods of time of shattered wastelands, and then we rebuild and we grow. And if we could come to some peace and wholeness and understanding that that is the flow of life, we would be less apt to just look at others as having some magic that we don't have, or some knowledge or insight or gifts or talents that we don't have, and that we could never possibly achieve what they've achieved in their life or in their relationships. But we all have that. We all have the capacity to take the hand that life has dealt us and create something beautiful for ourselves. And then learn to love and feel emboldened by the beautiful life that we've created. So that's the theme running in the story today. And it was inspired by an email that I received, not directly from Brandon Demchak, but I'm not even sure I'll have to ask Brandon who Liz Ellis is. But Liz sent me an email and said, I'd like to introduce you to my friend Brandon Demchak. He's an Army veteran. He served for 6.5 years with the 82nd Airborne Division. He did 2 tours of duty in Haiti after the earthquake and then in Iraq. He's a Central Coast native. He came home and, like many of our veterans, struggled to get his feet underneath him again. When he was back home, and through the best efforts of the VA and the best efforts of his own coping mechanisms, got into trouble and then has fought to find his wholeness amongst his shattered life and found a gift for storytelling and filmmaking. And he's in the process of finishing his coursework at Loyola Marymount, and he is in pre-production for a film that he wrote himself called Firecracker. And she said, would you like to meet him? And I said, heck yeah. Sounds like my kind of guy, this ordinary man doing extraordinary things. And so Brandon's here in the studio with us today to talk about his journey, his service to the military, his process of learning about that conundrum we all face about the importance of service to our country, service to others, but also service to ourselves in order to really create wholeness in our lives. So we're going to talk to Brandon. We're going to open up the phone lines and invite you to be part of the conversation. I am Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can reach us at 805-781-3875 once we get the phone lines open. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can check out our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or find us on Instagram, EW Barrett. TRT, and my wonderful daughter keeps kind of uploading new information on Instagram, so you can follow us. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org. All of the shows are up there from the last 10 years, and Tyler's great about getting shows posted right after they air, so you can listen on demand. And you can always podcast through Apple Podcasts, find A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and our shows will be uploaded to your device. So that's where we are today. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio. We'll be back to start our conversation with Brandon Demchek.
It feels like that. You think you're lost, but you're not lost on your own. You're not alone. I will stand by. I will help you through when you've done.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Brandon Demchek. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's start with Liz, who first sent the email and introduced you to me.
Yeah, Liz is, she is a producer on Firecracker. She's also the crowdfunding expert. So she set up everything for us. She worked very hard, and she's been making a lot of these contacts with people like yourself, getting me and just talking to people and trying to raise us the money for the film.
So before we jump into kind of the story of how you came to write the film and the film itself, let's just talk about where you are in this moment with the campaign, because you're in pre-production to get this film made, which people spend years and years hoping to get a film made. So tell me where you are and what the process is.
So we are at the very end of our crowdfunding campaign. We have literally, including today and tomorrow, it's the end of today and tomorrow, the last days to donate. We are about $3,000 away from our goal, but we are about 100, not about, we're exactly $178 away from being greenlit. Which means we have to raise 80% of the money for Seed and Spark, which is the company that is running our campaign, for them to release us the money. We have to make at least 80% in donations, and we're $178 away from that as of right now.
And so you can feel it.
Yeah, we've raised $12,222. As of this moment, and it's like, it takes is one person, you know.
Yeah,
what I
someone
mean?
Who and gets excited. Yeah. And so, Seed and Spark isn't like your regular GoFundMe campaign. It's different, right?
It's different. They only do films, and they're very selective of who they choose to work with. So we got really lucky. I think what the story's about and kind of. I think it really struck a chord, and not only with them, but once we went live with the campaign, people from all over. I mean, we got private donations, we got people just, I was very surprised when we had like a $15,500 donation goal. I was like, ugh.
It's never going to happen.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, of course, I think of myself, I'm like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to fail. You know what I mean? All the mm-hmm. things we go through every time we try something new.
Right.
And it was, the response was overwhelming. I mean, we were almost going to make it.
So Seed and Spark is holding the funds. They only do films.
Yep.
When you hit your mark, they'll release that, and then you go into actual production. And just to right up front, we'll say, you know, if you want more information about the campaign, making a donation to the film, it's BrandonDemchak, DemChak.com. And on your homepage,
right.
you have links.
Yeah, right on the homepage, it says Seed and Spark campaign, donate here. You just click on that.
And then you can also call into the studio, and Tyler has that information. He'll be happy to share with you as well. So let's talk about, now let's backtrack
sure.
To how you found your way to writing this film. You're a Central Coast native, as I mentioned before,
yeah.
born and raised here, a proud graduate of Napomo High School.
Napomo
you're
High
a Titan,
School.
First graduating class.
2005, first graduating class.
That
yeah.
was monumental.
Yeah.
And then you left high school in what?
Well, I left high school and, you know, immediately tried to go the college route, community college, just trying different things. I had no clue what I wanted to do. You know, when I hear 18-year-olds say, I know exactly what I want to do, I kind of chuckle because I'm like, I don't think you do, you know?
Cause you have some good ideas.
Yeah, some great ideas. But yeah, no, so I tried a little bit of everything and school just wasn't for me. I was a tattoo artist for a little while because I like drawing. I always liked creative stuff, always loved it. And I just got kind of lost for a couple years, really. Getting into trouble, you know, not really with the law, but just kind of myself doing stuff
that your parents probably weren't
that my
proud
parents
of.
Probably wouldn't be proud of, exactly. And eventually I reached a point when I was 21 years old, I felt like I had nowhere to go. I know my parents were kind of like over, like helping me at this point because mm-hmm. I wasn't going to school. I was always my dad's thing. He's like, if you're in school, I'll help you out, but if you're not, you're on your own.
Right, right.
And so I was at that point kind of on my own, and I knew I had to go somewhere that would be a steady paycheck, would be a steady, would be somewhere I'd be stuck for a while.
But and maybe a place to ground you a little bit?
Yeah, exactly. And I knew the military was a good option because it would give me that discipline mm-hmm. To basically become a man. I thought I was a man at that point until, you know, day one, getting off the bus at basic training, you find out what you really got, you know, man or woman, if you really got the guts to do it.
And was the military part of your family history?
No, my grandpa, my mom's dad was in the military. He was in Korea. He actually went to basic training right here in Camp San Luis Obispo. But he never really talked about it that much. He, you know, was very, I think he was only in for a couple of years.
And how did your family feel then about you taking this path?
My dad was all for it.
He's like,
oh yeah, that'll straighten him out, you know? And my mom, of course, was nervous because of what I signed up to do. I signed up to be a paratrooper and to fight, basically, because I knew when I was a kid, I was like, no one sits at a desk and plays army. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? You go in the backyard with sticks and, you know, go pew pew from behind trees. Like, that's what I wanted to do, like they did in the movies. And so that's what I signed up for. So she was a little nervous.
And so tell me what happened then from enlisting. What was your journey?
I enlisted went to basic training in Fort Benning, Georgia.
My dad was there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool, yeah. Yeah, Fort Benning, Georgia for basic training. Spent a little time there afterwards for airborne school because we had to learn how to jump out of airplanes properly and not get killed trying to do it.
That would be important.
and then went to Fort Bragg, 82nd Airborne.
And so did you feel like you'd made a right choice? You know, like, did it feel all these steps like, oh, I'm in the right direction. This is where I needed to be. Did it feel good?
Yeah, it felt, I mean, obviously it wasn't like the funnest thing I ever did, basic
right.
training and airborne and all that stuff. And there was a lot of rules that, you know, I wasn't very accustomed to, but I knew it's what I needed and I knew exactly what I was signing up for. You know what I mean? Some people just got to basic training, their eyes lit up going like, what did I just do?
And I always wonder how
I wasn't one of those guys. I kind of knew exactly what I was getting into.
And so then you go through basic, you get your first deployment to Haiti for the earthquake relief. What was that like?
Well, we were at the time we're on, it's called the Global Response Force. So basically there's, I mean, this is what they say, but apparently there's a phone in Washington, D.C. and a phone at division headquarters at the 82nd Airborne. When that phone rings, whoever's on GRF goes.
What does GRF mean?
Global Response Force. Sorry.
Thank you. That's all right.
Yeah. I'm used to the acronyms. That's an army or military thing in general. There's thousands of them. But yeah, so Global Response. So the earthquake happened and we were deployed about 48 hours later. We were sitting on an airfield in Haiti.
And so what was your, because you're a paratrooper, so I can't imagine there was jumping out of planes.
No. At this point, especially in the war and stuff like that, the paratroopers were designed to be the first ones in, and especially in Iraq, Afghanistan, stuff like that. Haiti, we don't need to paratroop in because it wasn't a war situation.
Right.
So we just flew in, you know, like the rest of them. Walked off the plane instead of jumped off it.
Were you hands-on, like passing out water or rebuilding?
Yes, we were very hands-on. The first couple of days we were on the airfield, we were sitting there just waiting to get told what to do. And then about 2 days after we got there, we drove straight into the city and it was bad. I mean, it was as bad as you can imagine, you know? And what we did as infantrymen, because we were infantry paratroopers, we're not supposed to be handing out rides, but we were handing out rides, doing what we can, but we were also security and stuff like that, just to make sure nothing, because that country at the time was really volatile. I guess in 1994, it almost, you know, got taken over, so we were there to kind of make sure nothing really.
So you were
went.
The stabilizing
exactly.
force, so that the aid workers could come.
Yeah,
in
they could do whatever they wanted, and they did. I mean, everybody did a really good job while we were there, but the first week we were there was pretty rough.
And did that feel like this has given my life kind of a sense of grounding? Like, were you finding that purpose that you had looked for at that point?
Not really, because at the time when we were. I mean, I was an infantryman. I was like, why do we want to go to Haiti? We want to go to Afghanistan. We
so
want to go to Iraq.
You still had the fight in you.
We wanted, we're like little pit bulls caged up. You know, we wanted to go fight. But then we went to Haiti, and it was like, this isn't what we wanted to do. And then what we actually got while we were there, I mean, kind of just shook me up, really. Just the stuff we saw, it was awful. I mean, the amount of hopelessness that country saw at that time was just... It wasn't what it did to me isn't half of what it did to them, you know what I mean? So I couldn't imagine, but it was hard for a little 21-year-old guy who's never seen anything to that extent. Was pretty tough on not only myself but the rest of my guys too.
And how long were you in Haiti?
I was there for about 4 months.
And
January to May, we left in like middle of May,
so you didn't even hit the summer.
No, it got hot though. Yeah, it was in the 90s and it's humid. I mean, you're just sweating the second. And we were laying in tents. We didn't have, the accommodations were not great.
And so after Haiti, you come back, and then when did you go to Iraq?
We went to Iraq almost a year later, almost to the day. We went the next May.
And how was that different?
Iraq was different because we got to do our job, our job title, you know, as infantrymen, we got to go do what we were trained to do. And the living conditions were a lot better than Haiti, only because the war had been going on for, I think, 8 years at this point.
Yeah, what year were you?
I went in 2011.
Okay.
So pretty late compared to, you know... a lot of other soldiers out there went in like 2003, 2004, and it was just like mayhem. It was a little more calmed down by the time we got there, but still not the funnest place to go, you know? But the living conditions were a little better, of course, because it was built up.
And what was your day-to-day like then?
Day-to-day, you know, I worked for the battalion commander. So I was basically under him the whole time. We worked at a headquarters. Wherever he went, we would, go with him. Me and a lot of other guys too. There was a bunch of guys in my little group. Like higher up guys would have to go to different parts of Iraq at different times, and we'd get on a helicopter and go with them, or get on a MRAP, which is the big like tank looking thing on four wheels, and go with them. So we were like their security, personal security.
Were you jumping out of any planes?
No, not at that point.
Did you ever get to jump out of a plane?
Oh, yeah, I jumped out of a plane. I mean, in Fort Bragg in training, I jumped over, I think, 40 times, 45 times or something like that.
But not in combat?
Not in combat, no. They hadn't jumped in combat since very beginning of Afghanistan. Okay. And I think I won in Iraq, too. I don't remember.
And so how long were you in Iraq?
I was in Iraq for about 9 months.
And so I guess how I would imagine that was the period of time that started to change.
That's what a lot of people think, but I think Haiti is the place where really that's where, because what I saw in Haiti really kind of set me up for what happened eventually in Iraq, to where I was just kind of numb to stuff like that at that point. Because the amount of, I guess, carnage is the only right word for it in Haiti we saw. I mean, 250,000 people died like that, you know, and 3 days when we started going into the city, 4 days, it's not enough time to clean up that many people.
No.
So by the time we got there, by the time we got to Iraq, it was like, that's what dead people look like. You know what I mean?
You had been desensitized
exactly.
to that
yeah.
experience. And I don't know, but I'm wondering if seeing a natural disaster carnage would be different than man-made carnage, because that's, you're expecting the death of war. It's part of the price.
It could be. Yeah. I mean, that's, I've never thought about it like that, but yeah, that's kind of interesting to think about for sure.
Yeah. That it's more unnerving for the psyche because you're not prepared for what the magnitude can be.
Yeah. I think too, whatever happened in Iraq, we always think about could have been preventable and stuff like that too.
Right. And so this makes you feel extra even thing smaller to think about. And weak in those base of the world,
right? Yeah,
this can come.
You know, things happened in Iraq. You know, two of my good friends passed away when we were in Iraq because of combat related, you know, injuries, and I wasn't there. You know, so I think what if I was there? What if I, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. I heard it. I wasn't far from it. You know, I know what happened. I saw when they came. You know, they came running back in, but it was like, what if I was there? You know, that's like the biggest thing. A lot of my friends think the same thing. And the friends that were there, they're like, what could I have done differently?
How can I have some control when things are out of control?
Yeah, Haiti, it's like, how do I just not see that anymore? How do I not look? Because it was almost unavoidable.
Right, because you weren't retreating
no.
to the base.
No.
There was, surrounding you. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. My guest is Brandon Demchak, and we're talking about his time serving in the military and working our way to where he is today as a filmmaker and writer, getting ready to produce his first film, Firecracker. Charlie, you've been waiting a while. What's on your mind today? Oh, and I don't hear Charlie.
But we did hear one of the people I really wanted to talk about was there's a Navy psychiatrist, Davy Jones, talked about taking care of combat fatigue or shell shock or whatever. It is not an aberration. It's considered a normal response to a very abnormal situation. And his approach was to pull people from the front line, but have them stay in a tent near sound of combat. It was called 3 days. It's called three hots and a cot, three hot meals and a place to sleep, in uniform, being visited with the idea of being, if they kind of recovered from the initial thing, return to combat. And he, of course, this was before PTSD was as well defined. We're talking about mid-90s. But he felt that would very definitely reduce the incidence of PTSD and really help people stay with the unit. Because if you pull somebody from the front lines, they got to replace them with a new person, but with the idea of the expectancy of returning to combat. And I'm not sure if your guest had any experience with that type of thing, but I think it was very revealing. I don't know if there's been any follow-up studies on how well that related to whether that was reduced the incidence of PTSD, but it was definitely a very definitely not the general Patton approach.
Absolutely not. And it definitely started the conversation. And I'm glad that Charlie brought that up, because that's where we're going to go to what happened once you came back from Iraq. And then you were honorably discharged after 6.5 years of service. How did you make that transition? Because I've heard that quite a bit, that one of the most difficult things for soldiers is being separated from their unit, from their division, from their brothers.
Right.
So how did you deal with that?
Well, the way to deal with it at the time was to not deal with it.
Okay.
So what I did, of course, when you're first going through it, you don't know you're going through it. Your body changes gradually. It's not very sudden. At least it wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I woke up one day fine and the next day I was,
had PTSD.
Right. Yeah. It's more of a gradual thing. And you find out in certain actions you may take differently in different situations.
Well, and imagine too, when you're first discharged, the mm-hmm. joy of going back.
Oh, it's the best.
Overwhelms
yeah.
any concerns about, but who will I be when I'm not a soldier anymore?
Right.
And do you get any preparation? Does the VA pull you aside, or your commander, and say, hey?
They try.
Okay.
They try.
Okay.
Especially when you're getting out of them. Let's see, I got back from Iraq at the end of 2011, and I didn't get out till 2015. So I was still in for a while waiting to deploy again. Mm-hmm. Well, I never got the chance. We just trained and trained and trained and trained until I got out. But
And would you so have it was gone like, back happily?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's like, I always liken it to, infantrymen, the only job you have is overseas, so it's like playing for the Dodgers but riding the bench the whole time. You could watch the game but you can't play,
so that's even like though you've been, yeah. And so even though this PTSD was kind of brewing
right
from your experience back in Haiti, the soldier in you was still ready to get back,
ready to get back.
It almost, Charlie was saying, get back to combat.
It almost seemed like it would have helped.
Then
I think that's what he was saying.
Yeah, yeah.
It was kind of like just like take a little break. But we never talked about it either. I knew guys were drinking more. I knew guys were doing other things that we weren't supposed to be doing in the military. I was doing it myself. I was drinking much more than I ever did, trying to just kind of quiet stuff down. You know what I mean? And of course, you rationalize it in your head, like, oh, I'm a paratrooper. This is what I do. We work hard, we play hard. Mm-hmm. And really, we were just kind of trying to keep things quiet in our own minds.
And I read that on your story too, that you said, I was trying to quiet that noise in my head that doesn't ever go away.
Right.
And that noise is the things you saw.
Right. Yeah. The things I saw, or the things that I could, like I said earlier, like what if I was there? Mm-hmm. Like that's always kind of, what if I had been there? What if I had seen it? What if I, or
is it survivor guilt, or is it?
I don't know if survivor guilt or just, that's probably, I mean, you would probably be better equipped to answer that than I would, but it's just those, and it's not only that situation. There's hundreds of situations right. where you're just like, what could I have done differently?
Well, your life is on the line every single day. So, I'm assuming that there's a constant hyper arousal you're experiencing while you're deployed. And then you come home and you're supposed to turn that hyper arousal off and just watch Monday Night Football.
Right. And it doesn't turn off right away.
That becomes the noise.
That becomes the noise as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You hear fireworks. You hear a dumpster can, someone just lets the top go and it smacks on the ground or whatever, like that's those noise. If you're not expecting it, it could kind of catch you off guard and you're like, oh, whoa. And you're like, oh, it's just fireworks. Your mind knows what it is. I know it's just fireworks, mm-hmm. but my heart won't stop racing for hours. Mm. I don't know why. I don't know. And the only thing to calm me down, the only thing that worked at the time was, copious amounts of alcohol.
And because it's societally accepted.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just a heavy drinker.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of the point of what I want to get into, how I want to help veterans is ways that they cope with it. Mm-hmm. It's usually unhealthy ways of coping with it, because that alcohol does quiet the noise. It works at first. Mm-hmm. It works really well.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. And then it doesn't eventually. And it makes it worse.
So let's briefly talk about PTSD for people who might not know the mental health aspect of it, and then we'll transition into the inspiration for the movie. But
sure.
So PTSD is a mental health condition that is related to trauma experience.
Right.
And it's not just related to combat, but it's the result of experiencing or witnessing a life-threatening event, a trauma, either through combat, but also through natural disasters, which you saw in Haiti, being in a car accident, or experiencing sexual assault.
Right.
And not surprisingly or surprisingly, that higher rates of PTSD are actually seen in survivors of sexual assault, even in combat veterans.
Yeah.
But either way, the result of having experienced or witnessed this life-threatening event kind of becomes ingrained in the psyche, and then you start to experience symptoms, and it can be right away, but as you mentioned, it can be months later, and for some people it can be years later, and you don't even relate your behaviors or your symptoms to the event because it's so far away, or it happened so long ago, but which the three most common symptoms become reliving the event through memories or flashbacks or nightmares.
Nightmares, yeah, that's a big one.
The second most common set of symptoms are avoiding the triggers, avoiding going places or being around people or situations that remind you of the event.
Yep.
And you can start having trouble sleeping, trouble with eating, develop anger, easily irritated, start to withdraw from relationships, struggle with the hyperarousal, that you're always on edge. Mm-hmm. And then the third set of symptoms, which you talked about, are taking on coping mechanisms like heavy drinking, drug abuse. You start to feel physical pain, and pain in your relationships and relationship struggle. So those are kind of the three categories of symptoms that are related to PTSD. And then when I looked at there's a lot of different treatments that are available, but I wanted to look at the VA's website about treatments because I'm assuming that that's where you turn to.
Yes.
When you first started to realize, I'm not just heavy drinking, I'm struggling.
Right.
And so the VA mentioned, you know, that their primary focus is trauma-focused psychotherapies, which are the ones most highly recommended, and they give 8 to 16 sessions, prolonged exposure therapy.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cognitive processing therapy.
Uh-huh.
And EMDR, which is a eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. So they, I don't know if you did any of that.
No, I didn't. That sounds interesting.
It has very high success rates because it's taking the trauma and desensitizing your trigger response to the trauma. And so that all of a sudden it just becomes a story that you tell and it doesn't have the physical response to it.
Interesting.
And then their second line of defense, of course, was medications. And
I did that too.
and then they have four antidepressants that they recommend specifically for PTSD: Zoloft, Paxil, Prozac, Effexor.
Right.
Did you take any or all of them?
I took Zoloft, yeah.
Okay.
Wasn't a fan.
Okay. So that's what the VA recommends, along with they have other different treatments that they use, but that's the main line of defense.
Right.
So what was your experience with these treatments through the VA, and how did you...
So those treatments through the VA, the VA is the one who diagnosed me with PTSD. When I was getting out of the military, you go through all this stuff for disability claims and stuff like that, and I started talking about stuff that happened to me in Iraq. And he's like, okay, any other deployments? And I said, yeah. Because actually, I was getting checked for anxiety disorder.
Okay.
Because I thought that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, okay, ask me about Iraq. And then he goes, any other deployments? I said, yes, I did one to Haiti as well. And he said, hold on. And he got up and came back with PTSD paperwork. Because I guess he had gone through Haiti people before, you know, like.
That you weren't the first
one. I wasn't the first one, no. So then that's when I got diagnosed with PTSD, and I did nothing about it at the time. I was like, oh, sweet, you know, I might get a few bucks a month because of this or something, you know.
Disability.
But because at the time I was drinking, I was fine.
You thought you had
it all. I thought I had it all figured out, you know. Even though I was still having nightmares, I'd still jump up out of bed thinking we're getting mortared and stuff like that. But that was that night. I was okay. You know, nothing happened during the day. But so it wasn't until I was out of the military and that my way of coping wasn't working anymore. It just was not. In fact, it was getting way worse. you know, going around my apartment, checking to make sure all the doors were locked, all the windows were tightened, you know, the baseball bat was in the right corner so I knew where to find it, stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Weird things that, like, normal people just don't do, they don't think of. And so I knew I needed to try to get a little help, so I went, and the very first thing right off the bat is meds. That, I mean, if any veterans are listening to this, they could probably relate. The VA likes that easy fix.
Bowls of meds.
Here you go. And I did the Zoloft, and there were some side effects I wasn't a fan of, so I just stopped taking them. Didn't even ask the doctor. I was like, nope, not worth it.
Which is not recommended.
Right.
Please don't take yourself off any psychotropic meds.
Again, I'm
without
not an
doctors.
Expert.
I just want to make sure that we're clear about that.
Yes.
That was not a wise choice.
I was not in a good headspace at all at the moment. I don't do that, please. Don't try this at home. But that's what I wasn't on them for very long. I just, the side effects were just greatly outweighed why I was taking them. And so I, again, just kept using the drinking, and then it kept getting worse and worse and worse. 4th of July rolls around, all this stuff, and I'm going like, I really can't do this. I can't do this anymore. And it reached a point where I started to think about making permanent decisions.
Suicidal
thoughts, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I always tried to think of ways to do it so it didn't look like I did it myself. Mm-hmm. Like an accident, stuff like that. I mean, just fantasizing. Like every time I went to the top floor of a building, I would think, where's the best place to do it? Where's the best place to look like I tripped or something? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Things like that. Like really, and it was weighing on me and it wasn't good. And the alcohol was certainly taking a toll on my body because the amount, you know, it starts off small, but then eventually your body just gets used to it and you have to keep drinking more and more and more. And my body was just being pickled from the inside, basically, from the amount of alcohol I was taking in. And the noise in my head just would not stop. So I stopped drinking.
Did you just wake up one morning and say, I'm done?
I wish it was that easy. No, I went through a 12-step program, and that basically changed my life. But now I didn't have that coping mechanism anymore. That was gone. I had to deal with it now. And so I went back to the VA to try and deal with the PTSD, and that's when they got me into the prolonged exposure. And I hated it. I could not stand it. I felt, I know other veterans could probably relate to this. I felt stupid when I was doing it. It felt
reenacting it over and over and
it
over
just,
again.
It didn't seem right. I mean, I was laying back with my hands facing up and in a relaxed position going over the accounts of Haiti and Iraq in my head. And it just didn't, I left feeling worse. I know that's part of the process, but I didn't want to go. I just didn't. I found my relief in other ways.
So at what point, what time was this then? What year?
This was probably about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Brandon Demchak. He is the writer of the movie Firecracker, which we are going to talk about. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to set some precedence for the story of how Brandon got to the point where he needed to save his life, going through a 12-step program, getting clean and sober, and then finding a new direction for his life. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to continue our conversation and to take your calls.
Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm gonna need somebody to lean on. Please swallow. Brother, when you need a hand.
Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is Brandon Demchek. And as always, time goes so quickly, and I want to make sure we spend time talking about your recovery and this beautiful movie that you've written. So you found yourself going through the 12-step program about a year and a half ago. And then how did you discover that you had a story to share and a gift for telling stories?
Well, so when I got out of the military, I had gone straight to school, basically, the GI Bill, which highly recommend if there's any veterans out there listening,
utilize
not
your
using
benefits.
It. Please use it. It is amazing. But I was already going to film school. So I was doing that, but I was still kind of drinking and stuff like that. So I was just not taking full advantage of it. And one big thing you learn in film school, especially writing, is write what you know. Write what you know, write what you know. They always say that, write what you know. The best stories come from something that probably happened to you, or, you know, obviously Superman's not about a guy who could fly around, you know, like the guy who flies around didn't write Superman, but he probably wrote it coming from something. Like he wanted to be Clark Kent, or he felt like Clark Kent at a certain point. You know what I mean? So it's write what you know, write what you know. And I was like, I know I have this story, especially once I got sober. I know I have this story that needs to be told. And I think people will want to see it, especially veterans who are probably going through the same thing I'm going through or was going through.
And families or anyone who loves
someone
who's been through this.
Exactly. So I decided to just start writing it. And it's a short. It's not like a big, long movie, but it's going to be, it was like 20, 30 pages. And I really had to get it
come out of you.
It did. Yeah. The first draft just came out of me.
And can you tell the basics of the?
Yes, of course. Yeah. It's about a veteran struggling with PTSD and severe alcoholism. And that's how he copes with it, you know, because that was always my thing. I was like, there's so many movies about veterans and PTSD, and they're in the backyard digging a hole to sleep in it and stuff. It just shows PTSD,
right. But
it doesn't show the destructive ways they might be dealing with it in the form, like with me, was alcohol. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in Iraq, we lost two people from my battalion, and they were in my company, and they were two of my friends. I mean, they were very close two people. And since we've been back from Iraq, we've lost 6 to suicide. Those numbers don't make sense to me. 2 to 6, you know, that doesn't 3 to 1. It's
right,
not.
'Cause getting home should be
the fun
gift,
part, the
right.
Great part. Yeah, but it's not, you know. So those two people are the only two I'll ever lose in Iraq. Obviously, that's not saying all the other people who've lost. So times my 2 to 6, you know, the 4,000 or however many have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, I don't remember the exact number. There's probably someone listening right now. Mm-hmm. It's this number. But times that by, you know, 3. And that's that's how
the
many.
Suicide rate's much higher.
Way higher. Mm-hmm. It's 8,000 a year.
And so it's interesting because we talk about therapies or psychotherapies and helping people to recover, gain mm-hmm. wholeness through, you know, rebuild once their life has been shattered.
Yeah.
Narrative therapy is probably one of the most effective therapies. It takes a long time, and I think it's one of the reasons that we don't use it a lot because people don't have the patience.
Right.
But written narrative therapy is basically telling your story, writing your story down, and then rewriting the story in a different way that's a story of healing and hope and possibility. So it sounds like you unintentionally did your own therapy.
That's exactly what I did, and I didn't even know I was doing it.
Well, you did. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Written narrative therapy. And so when the story came out of you, then who did you give it to?
Well, the story came. I wanted to write it for because the film school I went to, which Santa Monica College, at the time, that's where I was going at the time. I go to Loyola Marymount now, but they have a thesis film that you make as a film program, and they only make one. And we all had to write scripts for it. And so I was like, here's my chance. I could write this one and get a $30,000 short film made.
Wow.
And so I was like, well, that's the way to go. Well, my first draft could only be, we had like a limitation on how many pages it could be. And I just didn't get the story out that I wanted to get out. And of course it didn't get selected. Another one got selected. So we made that one instead. Great experience. It's called The Attempt. It'll be out soon. Anyway, sorry, shameless plug.
That's fine.
But, I wrote it for that. And then we were encouraged as well to just be like, hey, if your script doesn't get picked, you know, make it yourself.
Yeah,
so,
work
and
it.
You know, a couple people took that advice, including myself, and I got with a producer who I know very well named Rafael Saad. He's the best. He's from Brazil. And he kind of, we kind of finished the script together and kind of molded it into like a workable, shootable story. And he said, let's do it. And that was the day I was like, I don't know. And he was really kind of like the guy who was like, this is, we're going to tell this story. You need to tell this story. So I said, okay, let's do it. And here we are.
And so here we are, you know, you're in your last couple days of your crowdfunding through Seed and Spark. As you mentioned at the top of the show, you're $178 away from getting the funds released. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And you've written the story and you've rewritten your life story to have a different ending.
Right.
So where are you right now in your mental health and well-being?
I mean, it's so much better. From what I found that really helped me is helping other people.
Okay.
You know, especially through the 12-step program that you know, I'm sure you know all about that. And with veterans, you know, specifically veterans with drinking problems. I mean, that's kind of my expertise because I did that. That's what I went through. And so I always try to reach out with veterans. I go to the VA. I try my best to get into other veterans programs. I have another friend down there who works with this place called Merging Vets and Players. I'm starting to try to dip my toe into that to try and get in with him because it's just immersing myself with other veterans, especially veterans who are right in the right kind of that window's open for them to get help. And they're just like, and like,
it's not bad enough.
Just me kind of helping them through that little window into recovery is that will jack me up for 2 weeks and I'll have a good 2 weeks and then I find another one and help them. It's just like a never ending process of helping people. And in turn, it helps me. It's the best therapy I could recommend for anybody.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and it goes back to kind of the theme of the show, service to country, service to others, service to self.
Yeah.
And quite often in our culture, we reverse that and we go service to self, service to others, and what country?
Yeah.
And when we're backwards like that, you know, we can only give service to ourselves for so long and it becomes meaningless.
Yeah.
that we can only focus on ourselves.
Right.
That it's that flipping and feeling like you're a value to things greater than yourself.
Right.
That give you hope. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we've been having such a good time, but we'd like to open up the phone lines, 805-781-3875. If you have a question or comment you'd like to share with Brandon or myself, 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And, you know, it's interesting because I think of all of these different groups that are trying, different VA groups that are trying to help the returning veterans and you know, the desire to do well. And unfortunately with big bureaucracies, it's hard to find the small niche things. You know, I had Van Carras on the show back in the fall, and he does a group called Operation Surf, and he brings veterans in, which is beautiful. And there's groups that are taking backpacking trips, taking veterans out. And what seems to be the theme, and it's interesting because Charlie brought it up in his phone call, is that what's missing for veterans is kind of what happens to professional athletes when they leave their sport, is that when you are separated from the camaraderie, and firefighters experience this and police officers also, that when you are trained to rely on this other group of people as your family, and then you're taken from that family and plopped back somewhere else, even though it's home and it's supposed to be wonderful, that disassociation from that community, even if it's in war, is traumatizing in itself.
Yeah. I mean, when I got out of the military, everybody always asked me, what's the one thing you miss about the military? And I myself and thousands of other veterans, if they're being honest with themselves, they'd say the people. I miss my friends, you know, because those were some of the best friends I have ever made in my life. Of course, I have good friends around here and stuff like that, but those guys were, you know, we went through it together. And that's really what I miss the most, was having my friends around. And I think that's what holds people together while they're in.
Yes.
And when they're out, you can't bring all your friends with you.
Right. That you become, again, separated from that family that you know. And so even if you are struggling with PTSD and too much drinking while you're in the military, at least you had that community.
It was like a glue.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And a common experience.
Right.
And then you're separated from that. And it's And I know, you know, athletes go through periods of being lost and confused and taking a risky behavior. It's interesting that there is this common theme and why we don't do a better job of helping people transition to civilian life from whatever that experiences they've had.
The military tries. They have, you know, like a 2 month long program before you get out. But most people are 2 months from getting out.
They're so too excited.
They don't care. Yeah. They just do what they have to do and fill out the paperwork and get out. But, you know, they put you through an 8 hour PowerPoint presentation on how to buy car insurance and you're just like falling asleep.
Right.
So what would have helped?
But what did you need?
That's a really good question. I guess at the time, I don't know. I don't think I could have told you what I needed at the time. But now looking back, I think, that's a really tough question. I don't even know, you know, I have ideas that maybe they could have done the classes better, less PowerPoint. I honestly don't know. I wish there was, I had an answer for you there.
Well, I think about why the 12-step program is works for a lot of people, and it's because it gives you a sponsor and a community that holds you accountable.
Yeah.
And that's similar to the military experience or to a team experience. And so I'm wondering, and I don't know, I could be saying the most naive thing of all time, so I will take calls to tell me I'm dumb.
Sure.
But my thought is that how about that sponsorship out of the military where you are connected to other veterans who, instead of you having to find them and write a movie or, you know, that you're instead of having all of these classes, you're actually kind of given a whole nother group.
That's actually an interesting idea is having, I mean, this is the first time I thought of it. The first time you thought of it probably too is having that veterans help people get out of the military.
Right.
That's interesting.
And have that be their job.
I think with the VA and stuff, because that's who runs the program of helping people get out, they have veterans come in, but it's like their job and they don't really care much about it.
It's not like a sponsor or a community.
It's like a guy who's paid, you know, however much money to babysit some guys getting out of the military for a while. I think like a volunteer program, I guarantee there's a ton of people who would do it because I had thousands of questions when I was getting out of the military and thousands of packets of paperwork that I didn't really know which was what was what. I had to go ask a lot of questions. You really have to do it all by yourself. Mm-hmm. Even though they try to help you, you have to be a real go-getter to get out of the military. It's tough.
And if you're dealing with PTSD and not knowing you have PTSD, then you're also coping with your coping mechanisms.
Right.
And your family, I would imagine everyone is so excited to have you back.
Yeah.
That you don't want them to think you're not as excited to be back because you don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. Like, I'd really like to go back to combat instead of sitting here with you at dinner. That must be hard for families
to
cope with.
Yeah, I remember when I first got back from Iraq, my mom started asking me questions and I immediately looked her in the face. I said, don't ask me because I don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Not that I don't want to talk about it, but you probably definitely don't want to hear about it. You know what I mean?
And you want to protect her from experience which you experienced.
But she's also curious and it's not really fair, you know, for other people because then I just come off like, rude and kind of weird and then that affects me and it's like a whole cycle that it starts the ripple effect of PTSD and alcoholism has on people, on not only on myself but my family. I might be quick with my mom on accident or my girlfriend or my friend and then I ruin their day and then they ruin some. It's like a ripple effect that one person going through a lot of struggles is having and it's hard to stop.
Well, and it's everyone just wants.
Hard to control.
I would say. Well, because that quick to irritability is part of the hyper arousal. And I wish we had another hour to delve into it because now my mind is spinning and I just keep thinking of, you know, everyone wants to do best. There are so many people that wants to do well or right by veterans and by anyone who's coming out of a traumatic experience. And I think it is that community. It's having that mentor, having that guide, or having that person you can lean on. And I think that in written narrative therapy, which you've written with your movie Firecracker, could be the key because maybe you couldn't tell your mom all the stories, but you could have written it all down and then your family could read it and you have the experience of healing and writing it. And maybe that's where your next gift is after this movie
sure.
is you create this written narrative experience for veterans
right.
to write their own stories.
Yeah, there's actually, I actually went through it. I don't even know how I forgot to mention it, but there's through the Writers Guild in Los Angeles, there's a veterans writing program that I went through. I didn't write Firecracker in that program, but there was just, you know, 40, 50, 60 veterans writing stories, and they all had smiles on their faces. So
we've already solved that
yeah.
problem. It's the written narrative therapy.
Yeah.
Brandon Demchak, your website is brandondemchak.com.
Yes.
You're looking for the last seed and spark
yeah.
to fund your film Firecracker. It's in pre-production. If people want to make donations, be part of the experience,
yes.
they can make donations through your website.
Yep.
When the film is done, will you be bringing it to the Central Coast?
Oh, of course. We're going to try. I mean, we're doing all the film festivals, and the San Luis Obispo Film Festival is definitely one of the first ones we're going to. I think we're going to miss it this year or next year, but we'll be 2020 will probably be a lot of film festivals and stuff up here that we'll be getting to.
Well, then I hope you'll make me part of your stops when you come
of
back.
Course.
So we have to talk about this again. I want to
yes.
follow your story and your next written narrative wherever that takes you.
Definitely.
If you'd like to continue this conversation, find me on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX. I'll be back next week for another conversation. Brandon Demchak, thank you so much for your service.
Thank you very much. For having
for
me.
For being a part of my community.
Yeah, thank you.
Everybody's got a thing, but some don't know how to handle it. Always reaching out in vain, just taking the things not worth having. But don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama, 'cause I'll be standing on the side when you check it out. You say your style of life's a drag and that you must go other places, but just don't you feel too bad when you get fooled by smiling faces. Don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama. 'Cause I'll be standing on the side when you check it. Change.